You all have a perception that politics in this country is profoundly broken. That somewhere along the line is never perfect. It's never been perfect. Nothing human ever is. But somewhere along the line, we got profoundly off track in our politics. You know, I think your perception is probably the same as mine. I will start with a religious topic. I've personally just come to a new interpretation of the Christian concept of original sin. You all remember the story that gives rise to the notion of original sin. We're in the Garden of Eden. God tells Adam and Eve, don't eat of this fruit. Serpent comes along and says, come on, go ahead. It's good. Give it a try. It's like, God guy, he just doesn't want you to know how really good it really is. Come on, go for it. And they say, fine, you know, we'll do it. All kinds of terrible things happen as a result, right? That's my interpretation of the story anyway. What's going on there? Here's my new interpretation. I think it's new. Human beings, in their makeup, have a fundamental flaw. And that fundamental flaw is they want to believe what they want to believe. And they will discount evidence to the contrary, come what may. They will weigh evidence not on the basis of how it conforms to reality. They'll weigh evidence on the basis of their emotional needs to reach certain kinds of conclusions. Right? And we all have this flaw, all of us. And the only way to combat this flaw is to be vigilant and self-disciplined and honest with yourself to the extent that you can. And sometimes that doesn't mean you're never gonna fall. It means that you have to continually be honest with yourself in recognizing when you did and try to go back and correct those mistakes and look forward to ask yourself, am I believing what I want to believe because I want to believe it, or am I believing it because it's true? You know, so the serpent says to them, don't listen to God. Listen to what you want and believe that instead. Well, this is a fundamental problem with politics, because truth and politics are always going to be at variance with each other. They always have been in conflict from the very beginning. Because politics is about persuasion. Politics is about trying to accomplish things by working together rather than through coercion. When you resort to coercion, you've left the realm of politics and entered into the realm of force. And you can have power from force, but it's far less potent than power of getting people to voluntarily work together toward common ends. That's what politics is all about. But persuasion and truth-seeking are not always the same thing. We can get people to believe what we want them to believe by telling them what they want to hear and get them on their side, get their assent, get the power of their action joined with ours to accomplish what we want. So at its heart, politics and truth are always going to be in tension with each other. There's always an advantage to try to persuade people to come over and give you their support and their assent to your purposes without necessarily resulting to the cold hard truth. So we know that this is just a fundamental feature of human existence, that politics and truth have a very difficult relationship from the outset. Truth can be powerful. But since we all want to believe what we want to believe rather than what is necessarily true, lying is powerful as well. And not just flat out lying, but shading, manipulating, engaging in deceptive talk, ad hominem arguments, so on and so forth, right? So here's where we are in our contemporary life. In the 20th century, this ubiquitous problem between politics and truth It's always been there with human beings, maybe rooted in original sin, if you believe my interpretation. Reached a new level because we started having the technology, the technique, the means of communications, and sophistication in just the study of how it is that people operate psychology to turn casual lying and deception into a science and to be organized on a massive scale. Right? So it's not now somebody at the town square whispering that the opponent in the election is dishonest. It's somebody going on TV with poll-tested results spreading deception and lies. That, by the way, may have nothing to do with the real issues that we face as a society. This is where we are. And so much of the whole political apparatus is set up to do this that it then inculcates a kind of cynicism and detachment on the part of people. So a lot of folks end up assenting to the status quo simply because they're overwhelmed by the mendacity in the system. They don't have the resources and the time to sort out who's telling the truth and who's lying, or even grading on a curve about who's worse and who's better. So they just say, to heck with all of it. I think they're all a bunch of bums. And what does that do but give power over to the least scrupulous, the most willing to do whatever it takes to get power? And that's why our politics is really broken. So I just tell you at a personal level, to be running for Congress in this system at this historical time is a fairly constant assault on my own sense of integrity. It's sort of a degrading process at a personal level in a lot of ways. And I'll just give you an example of it. I've been a college professor my entire life. Now, when I was a young man, I did very well in school. I always got very good grades. Honestly, I didn't necessarily have to work hard to do it. It just came easily to me. I think overcoming how easy it was for me by learning some self-discipline is actually something that had to come much later in life. I just showed up and took the test and I got an A, and I didn't quite figure out why the other people weren't able to do that. And it took me a while to realize that there are times when you just have to work hard in order to do well. And so when I graduated from college, there were a lot of paths open to me. I could have become an attorney. I knew people in my hometown, even though I'm a working class kid. I could have made a lot of money. I decided to become a teacher. And the reason I decided to become a teacher is that one of my high school jobs was teaching dyslexic kids how to read. And I just found it really fulfilling. There's nothing else I had ever done at that point in my life that meant much to me. It made me feel like my life was of more value than just, you know, goofing around like most kids do than that. So I went into teaching. Instead of going into the lucrative path of making a lot of money, I decided I wanted to be a teacher and a researcher. And so I went off and got a PhD. And I've taught my entire career, and I've been evaluated gazillions of times. And throughout that entire time, my evaluations, just telling you honestly, have ranged from really good to stellar. I have flaws as a teacher. I'm not good at the administrative stuff because that's just not what motivates me. I don't always get the forms back on time. You know, it's just not my thing. But as far as the fundamental value of what's going on, I take my craft seriously. I'm really good at it. And it's not just my opinion. I've been evaluated time and time and time and time and time again. And this is what other people say as they evaluate me. Because, you know, people don't know this, but academics are probably the most evaluated people in the world. We're evaluated by the students after every class, by our boss after every semester, by our boss after every year. Then there are 3-year reviews, and then there are 10-year reviews, and then there are post-tenure reviews. It's just review, 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 and it's always evaluation of evaluations of evaluations. I'm pretty good. And you know, I gave up lots of other options. So here's what's going on. So the guys on the other side did a public records request. And they got all the teaching evaluations, and they combed through thousands of teaching evaluations, and they took negative comments out, and they said, this guy is terrible at his job. He is terrible at his job. He's drawn a paycheck, and he's not going to work. And there are, you know, X percent of negative evaluations. Now, to put that in context, New College, college evaluation of students, the first thing is, what clearly impresses you about this instructor? And the second question is, what about this instructor could be improved? So they took that, and of course, as you can well imagine, students in that setting will say, well, you know, he didn't always get the papers back in time. And they said 70% negative evaluations. Well, you know, so running for office, now I have my wife crying at home. Because I've spent my whole life, and she's very proud of the fact that I do a good job at work. And this was, but here's why this should affect you. You know, so it is an assault on the dignity of the individual who undergoes this. And as you can, if you think about it, I'll be a little bit of a social scientist. In social science, we have a concept called selection bias. And that's where, you know, if you're trying to represent a population, you don't want a protocol of picking out individuals to represent that that pulls from one end of the pool or another, right? So like in surveys and polling, you got to watch out for selection bias, right? If you're only calling people at home in the day, you're probably going to get a different kind of population than the population at home. Well, if you have a system of picking out who's running for office, where people who have a sense of dignity and integrity are thinking, I don't want to have anything to do with that, who are you going to have left running? Seriously, think about it. If this is the way we're running it, that, you know, no matter who you are or what you are, you're going to come under some kind of attack. And it doesn't matter that it's fundamentally dishonest. In fact, that's completely irrelevant. All you need is a pretext to attack a person, to make them look like something they're not, and you use it. And then if the person comes back and says, wait a second, that's not true, they look defensive. Right? And the news report will be, well, there's a controversy here. Because we've abandoned the job that journalists during the professional era of journalism used to have, a standard called objectivity. And the idea of objectivity is that the journalist's job is to try to step out of this situation, evaluate the facts, and find the truth and report it. And we've degraded that standard and entered into a new standard called balance. And balance is not the same thing as objectivity, because what balance says is, I tell you that the earth rotates around the sun, and you tell me the sun rotates around the earth, and the news reporter comes in and says, there's a controversy here. Right? I mean, that's where we are. So you sling mud at the other guy, and then the guy says, well, wait a second, that's not really fair. Ah, there's a controversy. So, speaking hypothetically, you can be running against the most ethically challenged member of Congress and find yourself defending your teaching evaluations. Because now you've got, no, there are two arguments here. You see what I'm saying? Now, here's why this should disturb you. The selection bias thing, I think, is important. Because I'm not asking you to, you know, I'm not looking for sympathy. Personally. I just tell you, it's a very undignified thing to have to put up with this stuff. It really is. And you know, you certainly ask yourself daily, why in the heck would I want to do this? Okay, and I've been through it a few times. You're not going to get, you should be worried about this, because you will not get the kind of people you want leading this country when we have a process like this. You will not. You're going to get people who are egomaniacs. You'll get people who are, some of them are sociopathic. You're going to get a few people who have a really strong sense of duty and obligation, who will put up with this because they believe in what they're doing. And then you'll get a lot of people who you don't want having their hands on the till of power. So that's one reason you should be offended by this whole thing. But just as importantly, this country faces huge challenges. Huge challenges. The economy is a mess. And it's not just a mess because of something that happened 4 years ago. I just read a study yesterday put out by the Brookings Institution. It said from the years 2000 to 2007, workforce participation declined by 20%. What's that mean? It means that there are people in this country who've decided that participating in the formal labor market just isn't worth it. So they're not paying Social Security. They're not paying taxes. They're just working informally, doing odd jobs and stuff like that, because there isn't a place in the formal economy that is worth the bother to them. Those were the years 2000 to 2007. Supposedly in the middle of a boom, people, large sectors of the population are saying, it's not worth it for me to work in a job where I draw a salary, pay taxes, so on and so forth. I'm going to live with my parents. That ought to concern some of you. Yeah, I'm going to do odd jobs, work casually, off the books, because there just aren't opportunities out there that make it worth it. Another thing that happens at work is you get trained so you become more productive as a worker. Or you may take time out from your formal work life to go back and get more training so you can advance back in. If you drop out of the formal labor sector, you're not doing any of that stuff. So you're not investing in yourself, and we're not getting a more productive workforce. This was before this crash. Now, if this campaign goes on, and you're going to see one mud-slinging thing after another, where are we talking about that problem? Where are we addressing the fact that our economy has produced to a point where we have so many people who do not have even the incentives to participate in the job market that they're just dropping out? They're not productive. They're not becoming more productive. They're not paying taxes. They're not paying Social Security. They're on the margins. They have no prospects. And these are young people. And we're not even talking about that problem. That's why you should be concerned about the brokenness of the system. It's a mess. Nobody is even talking about that problem. So, you know, the fact that this system is broken means that the value of politics, despite the fact that it always has a tough relationship with the truth, is that it by definition, by nature, is the way that people can come together, address problems and work collectively to solve them, articulate projects and work together to achieve them. And our political process makes that impossible. We're not getting the job done. So let me tell you, now this is where, you know, I'll straddle the fence. You're going to start seeing some ads on being political as opposed to just talking to you as a citizen in your midst. You're going to start seeing some ads come up for my campaign. And now I've told you what they're really all about in my mind. The biggest problem we have in this country, as bad and as deep as the economic problems are, as concerned as we all ought to be about international relations, the biggest problem we have in this country today is that our political system is broken and we have to fix it. It certainly starts with Congress, an institution that is dysfunctional. First, you cannot keep electing the same people and expect different outcomes. But beyond that, you have to get people up there who understand where these problems come from and try to fix them. And the number one thing we need to do is get the role of money out of politics. And we've got to start right now. People worry about the debt and the deficit. They should. You know, we can all disagree about how quickly you ought to focus on immediate debt relief and so on and so forth. But long run, if we don't get control of spending and get it in line with revenues, we're all going to be in trouble. Important programs like Medicare are going to be threatened. We all know this is true. How can we fix that problem when you don't have a process that can even pass a budget? We have to fix Congress. And part of that's getting the role of money out of politics. Part of it is the changing the incentives, the rules for how things work. These are going to sound like processy kind of things. But we don't fix these problems, our country is in deep trouble. And the values that we think makes it great will not be realized. And we'll leave a legacy for our kids and grandkids that is lesser, not greater And I think we would be the first generation in American history that we could not look back upon and say they moved things in the direction of progress. Things regressed. So we've got to fix these problems, and that's part of why I'm running and what I want to do. And you'll see that talked about in the ads. It goes beyond just campaign finance, though. Money in politics is the biggest problem. It goes into every aspect of policy making. There's a great economist who uses a term for this. It's not one he made up. It's a long-standing term that economists and political scientists use. There's a guy named Joseph Stiglitz. Has anybody ever heard of him? He's a really smart guy. He's won the Nobel Prize twice. He's just written a new book, and he says the biggest problem we have in the United States is something called rent-seeking. I can't generally do this in stump speeches because now you've got to explain what rent-seeking is. And what he means by rent-seeking is when people in the economy are not trying to be more productive and make more wealth and then maybe get rich by doing that, but rather are using other means of grabbing a bigger piece of the pie that's already there. So not growing the pie, they're just grabbing a bigger share of the pie that's there. And rent-seeking especially applies to politics. So if you have, for instance, corporations who do corrections, trying to get politicians to privatize the correction process, where you're going to end up spending more for corrections than you did when it was done in the public sector, with outcomes that are the same, and then are going to turn around and lobby legislators to create more felonies so that you can send more people to prison, you're not increasing the productivity of this economy in any way, shape, or form. But you are making a few people rich. That's rent-seeking. And rent-seeking, if you look at what's going on in Washington and you look at why we have a deficit, it's rent-seeking all over the place. We need a strong defense. We need to be militarily strong. It's a dangerous world. Some of you may not even agree with me on these issues. But we waste billions and billions of dollars a year on weapon system that the Pentagon doesn't think we need. Why? Well, it's rent-seeking. Corporations going to members of Congress saying, these are jobs. You know, some people who hate Keynesianism suddenly become big Keynesians when defense spending comes up. You know, all government spending is wasteful unless it's on weapon systems, which by their definition, if they're successful, should never be used, right? Because they're deterrents, right? So you're not increasing productive capacity in generating wealth in the society. You're pulling it out. And that's probably necessary to an extent because it's a dangerous world out there. But if you're doing it, if you're pulling it out to create weapons that we don't need because some member of Congress has a defense contractor in their district, that's what's causing the deficit. And we had the specter last year of a congressional committee where the Joint Chiefs of Staff came before a congressional committee and said, we understand the country is facing some real economic challenges here. We have identified some places where we think we can carve some money out of the defense budget because there are some things in there that just really are not necessary for us. And we want to do our part to improve the economy. And the members of the committee said to the generals and the admiral and the joint chiefs, you're being unpatriotic. You're trying to weaken this country. Okay, that's rent-seeking, and that's a big problem. So R-E-N-T hyphen seeking. It's when you're looking for rent. I'll tell you, because I'll be a professor just for a second. It goes back to an argument that Adam Smith made in The Wealth of Nations. And he was very critical of the crown, the monarchy, that had a lot of land and then extracted wealth from people for using that land. And he believed in small-scale capitalism. And he says the small capitalist is trying to make a profit so they can take some of that profit, set it aside, and invest, increase their ability to produce stuff so they can make more profit. But we all benefit because jobs are generated, cheaper products are generated. You know, so there's that invisible hand effect of this. Prices go down, availability of goods go up. Where rent seeking is just taking money, other people's money out of the system, you're not generating any more wealth. So in the 20th century, right and left, economists came along and said, rent seeking in government is a huge problem. Because you can use the regulatory process not to come up with rules that will increase safety, but keep other people from competing with you in the market. You know, so you manipulate the regulatory process to make it harder for other companies to come in and compete with you. That's not increasing productivity. It's actually decreasing it. And example after example after example, privatizing this, that, and the other thing. A lot of privatization is based on the premise that the private sector is always more efficient than the public sector. Well, what's the argument? The private sector is more efficient than the public sector because there's a profit motive and there's competition, and that means you're always seeking ways of producing more at a lower cost than your competition. Governments don't necessarily have that incentive. That's the argument. But a lot of privatization is done in sectors of the economy where there isn't a market, where there isn't competition. So what are you doing? You're giving some private entity a right to make money off of something without really having to be more competitive, right? You know, this is a problem in the health sector. There isn't a private market for health, most health services. There just isn't. And there never will be, because most of us could not afford to pay for our health care out of our own pocket. And health care is also an odd commodity where the person providing the service generally determines how much of it you consume, not the person buying it. You know, so the whole argument of privatizing everything in healthcare to get more efficiency just overlooks the fact that you don't really have very much market competition in healthcare. So you got to figure out other ways of doing it. And you know, that's just the reality. Yes, sir. I can stop now and do questions if you want. That's fine.
My name is David, and you have excellent presentations. Stella.
Thank you.